This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, author Kianga Yamata Taylor joins us to talk about her new book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation.
It's an extraordinary story about how protests developed into a mass movement, where it is now and where it should go.
We speak with two founders of the D.C. and New York-based Black Movement Law Project.
Abi Hassan and Nash Sheard have put together a project that reflects the growing dynamism of the movement in the United States today. It's a great thing to behold.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Cornel West calls it the best analysis we have of the Black Lives Matter moment of the long struggle for freedom in America. Kianga Yamata Taylor's new book, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, explores how a new generation of black radicals, in challenging abusive policing practices, over-imprisonment of black persons, deeply ingrained stereotypes of African Americans as especially dangerous and devoid of humanity, along with other forms of racist state oppression, is carrying on the fight for black liberation through renewed activist uprisings. Combining historical accounts with insightful analysis, she demonstrates the interconnection between institutional racism and class oppression, reminding us how inequality and racialized state violence are byproducts of capitalism. Kianga Yamata Taylor is assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. She writes on black politics, social movements, and racial inequality in the United States. Welcome, Kianga, to Law and Disorder.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great.
We're very happy, very glad to get you on the phone. We tried once before and the phone line failed, and we understand that you had to get on a landline and had to go all the way to Chicago to do that.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad to be here now.
I thought before we talk about the book, I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, a personal question. How did you get from where you started out to where you are now to write such a book? I know you're an assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton. You've written for Black Agenda Report, International Socialist Review, a lot of other journals, and you're deeply involved in the movement here. Give me in a nutshell, how did you get to this place?
Well, I've been doing activism of one variety or another for a very long time. And I think, you know, for a lot of us who've been organizing for a period of time, the Black Lives Matter movement was right on time and was a relief in many ways. And so, you know, this was something I was tremendously excited about and really created an opportunity for me to think about and bring together a number of larger political questions about race and class in the United States. As an activist, as a socialist, I had been thinking about for a very long time. I think just in terms of the academic piece, I was working as a tenant advocate in Chicago and was just really curious about the issue of segregation, residential segregation, and how Chicago came to be such a deeply segregated city. And I went to grad school to figure that question out and, you know, and then eventually got a job that really put me in a position to think about these things, to write about these things, while also being able to maintain a relationship to movement activism. So, you know, that's kind of how I ended up in this situation. The new job created the time and space for me to actually be able to write the book a year ago, and I've spent the last couple of months going around the country talking about it, and it's been really good.
Great. We're talking about hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation by Kianga Yamata Taylor. Kianga, let's talk about the book, because it's in sort of two sections. One is how the movement has unfurled, and then secondly is the connections to a much broader vision of creating a new society. And you say that Trayvon Martin's murder united a generation. And can you talk about that? And then let's talk about Ferguson when it really came into its own. Can you talk about those two things, please?
Sure. I mean, the thing about the murder of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent acquittal of George Zimmerman, I think, really brought together a couple of things. One is black millennials, young black people, were instrumental in Barack Obama's victory in 2008. And I think with that came the expectation that things would be demonstrably different. People will have to go back and remember the Bush administration, the two terms of the Bush administration, and the impact that that had on black communities across the country, and the symbolic impact that had, particularly with what I describe as the federal government's collective shrug in response to Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And so this is all part of the backdrop to this kind of unprecedented outpouring of black support for Barack Obama. And, you know, I think Obama comes into office. And also I think it's important to say that Obama also cultivated this idea and image of hope, change, yes, we can, positioning his presidency as a break from that which came before it, that people completely bought into, and not just out of naivete at all, but that this was something that was consciously developed. And, you know, I think that the Trayvon Martin, his death and the acquittal of George Zimmerman really just sort of captures the profound disappointment with the Obama administration, and also how his presidency represented intense continuity with the past and little of the change that was represented. And, you know, and then there are specific things about his own reluctance to come out and publicly say something about the murder. And then when he finally does, it's couched in incredibly personal terms, which, you know, the mainstream media thinks is poignant. But I think for young black people in particular, it's profoundly disappointing, because he doesn't point to any of the kind of systemic issues that could result in Martin not just being killed, but George Zimmerman being coddled by Florida police and not being arrested. And really, the case demonstrating the fact that there are two sets of laws in the country, one for black people and one for everyone else. And that was ultimately on display when Zimmerman is acquitted. And Obama's response is, you know, we are a nation of laws, which is a complete kind of affront to the common sense of most thinking people, but particularly young black people who are sort of radicalizing through this experience. It's the impact of Troy Davis and the failure of the Obama administration to respond to that. It's the impact of the Occupy movement, elevating the issues of economic inequality while Obama is still blaming the personal habits of black people for disparities between African Americans and the rest of American society. And so Martin kind of pulls all these strands together, and I think when Zimmerman is acquitted, you get the beginning of the development of new organizations that in one way or another articulate the need for a different direction in black politics that is not completely bound up with electoralism. And so with Ferguson, you know, that in many ways is the culmination of all these kinds of little tiny crises throughout the Obama administration that come to a head. And so I write in the book that, you know, no one knows why a particular incident or moment is catapulted into a confrontation with the state or a social movement or anything like that. But, you know, in Ferguson, the killing of Mike Brown is sort of transformed from a typical police murder, if you can describe such a thing as existing, into a lynching when they leave his body on the streets for over 4 hours. When his parents arrive, they are held at bay by police for 4 hours looking at their son's body. The crowd knows that his parents are there. The police get increasingly more aggressive with dogs, with their firearms. And I think that in the context of what we would later come to know had been going on in Ferguson for years, how the mostly white leadership of the town was literally preying on its black citizens as the second leading source of revenue through a combination of fines and fees, arrest warrants, that, you know, all of these things came together in a particular moment and really exploded and became a touchstone for, I think, this same generation, but really the broader black population who had been suffering the indignities of police harassment, violence, and ultimately murder.
For listeners who may just be tuning in, we're talking with author Kianga Yamata Taylor and her wonderful book, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation.
I think the book is really a strongly intelligent book and addresses not only what's happened, but how we get from where we are to where we want to be. That's the importance of this book. Very important book. Kianga, let me ask you, you talk about the role of young black women in Ferguson and that they turned a spring of protests into a movement. Talk to us about that. That's really quite an extraordinary phenomenon that's going on. And no one, I think, in this country knows more about it than you. Tell us what's happening.
Well, I think that's been one of the more important and interesting developments in this particular iteration of the Black Liberation Movement is the role of the emergence of and role of black women, black queer women in organizing and leading the movement. Of course, black women have always played a central role in black political struggles, but usually it has been in the background, it has been something that has later been excavated, whereas today it is very upfront and central to the organizing of the movement itself. In some ways, I think that speaks to the complete and total social crisis that has engulfed the lives of young black men in particular. When I was writing the book, the New York Times came out with a very important story about the disappearance of black men in American society, that there are literally hundreds of thousands of young black men in general, really, who are unaccounted for, really because of premature death and in incarceration. And so in some ways, we have entire communities that have been devastated and gutted because of premature death and the impact and effects of mass incarceration that have created, in some sense, a political vacuum. And so black women in Ferguson, Ferguson was one of the places that the Times looked at that found, you know, literally tens of thousands of young men, quote-unquote, missing from Ferguson. And so I do think that this was some of the context, the wider context that creates a political vacuum for black women to very aggressively insert themselves into to try to stem the tide of social crisis in black communities. And so I think that is part of the objective reasons for why black women have played such a critical role in this particular period of the black movement. But I do think that there is also an important political contribution that has been made, which, you know, some people refer to as the politics of intersectionality and the idea that there are multiple dimensions of Black oppression in American society, that that oppression, anti-Black oppression, overlaps with gender oppression, it overlaps with class oppression, and so I think that this has been an important insight that many of these Black women organizers have injected into the movement. And perhaps most importantly, I think that they give a much broader view of what Black oppression looks like in the United States, where I think most recently it's been overwhelmingly focused on the social crises involving Black men, you know, which is incredibly important to talk about. But we cannot lose sight that the most rapidly growing pool of people who are facing incarceration are Black women. We cannot overlook the same destructive social forces that are preying upon young Black girls, even though there's been a focus on Black boys and young Black men. The same sorts of forces are at play in undermining the quality of life and the ability to live at all for young Black girls, the impact on Black trans women. And so I think that these Black women organizers have given us a much broader view of Black oppression, and the movement is better for it.
I wanted to ask you the difference between the new movement leadership that's come forward and the old leadership, and particularly Al Sharpton. And what was the role that the old leadership and Sharpton played in Ferguson? What's happening now?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of this got played up in the press as the generational divide between the kind of old civil rights establishment and the new activists. And to some extent, I think, you know, I think some of that characterization was true. But I think Sharpton's sort of sauntering into Ferguson and expecting people to instantly defer to him and expecting to simply step into some breach and take control of events there, you know, demonstrated something also more significant in terms of an idea of what leadership actually constitutes, an idea about what direction this, you know, at that point, not quite a movement, but what direction the protests needed to head into. And, you know, I think that Sharpton had been accustomed to playing a particular role over the last several years, that he has been the kind of face of family anguish in response to, in the aftermath of police killings. Sharpton has, you know, arrived on the scenes and led efforts to negotiate with local police and been the conduit to the Department of Justice. And, you know, in Ferguson, the reaction of local people there happened quite swiftly. And by the time he arrived on the scene, you know, there had already been daily protests. There had already been these publicized confrontations with the sort of over-militarized police there, which in some respects is probably why Sharpton was dispatched to Ferguson as opposed to Staten Island, where Eric Garner had been killed a few weeks earlier, or even Beaver Creek, Ohio, where John Crawford, the young man who had been on the telephone in a Walmart and was killed by police instantly upon their arrival, Sharpton went to Ferguson to directly intervene in events there and to really try to discipline the protesters and the kind of emerging local movement there. And, you know, he ran into a buzzsaw. He ran into people who were not interested in deferring to him, who had sort of in some ways come of age during his leadership, which had produced colorful sound bites and interesting photo opportunities, but had actually done nothing to stop police violence and police terrorism. And I think that for the young people of Ferguson, it was clear that it was their own activity, their own refusal to cave into the police, their own ability to stand up to the police that was driving local and even national events. And there was a kind of confidence that was developing as a result. And Sharpton, I think his reaction was to sort of bear down and insult people, which he did when he was delivering Mike Brown's eulogy several days after his arrival. And that would be his posture and stance towards this new developing group of activists over the coming months.
Kianga, let's talk now about how we get from where we are to where we want to be. That's a good part of your book, is that, and I wanted to share your insights with our audience. How do you move from protest to a movement? How do you build a movement? Malcolm X famously said, you can't get rid of racism under capitalism any more than a chicken can lay a duck's egg. And then he said, and if a chicken ever did lay a duck's egg, it would be a pretty revolutionary chicken. So I wanted to ask you about how we get from where we are to where we want to be. What kind of movement do you envision? Is this a movement that's independent of the foundations? How do you bring democracy to the movement? Can you build it online, or do you have to do something else? What are your thoughts about how we should get it together right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the key question, because you know, we all know that police violence and police brutality is not new. Racism in the United States is not new. And so what do we have to do to go from these periodic and important but periodic campaigns against police violence, for example, to really envisioning and ultimately living in a society where these types of campaigns are not necessary, because we don't have the kind of inequality that produces the pretext for policing and prisons in the first place. And so I think that in some sense we are, well, in every sense we're in the infancy of this movement, but I think that we can already see how the movement itself is engaging with questions that emerged, I believe, at the end of the sort of last period of significant black organizing in the 1960s and 1970s, which have to do with the systemic nature, racist violence and racist policing in particular. And so I think that that is an advance, and that is important to build upon. And so while, you know, you asked me about Sharpton earlier, well, people like that in the Congressional Black Caucus and mainstream political figures, the black political class in particular, would love to narrow this movement into one that is just focused on questions of body cameras and diversity of police departments, and you know, whether or not the police department should hire more black cops. I think some of the key organizers and organizations that are emerging out of this movement are really looking at how policing is connected to the inequality that is produced in the society more generally, and how in many ways the police exist to manage the impact and the results of inequality. And so in that sense, the movement has done quite a bit to expose the issue of police brutality, so that most thinking people no longer see this as just a question of a few bad apples or the rogue behavior of this or that cop, but understand it to be more systemic. And so I think the way that we go from exposing that to having a much more substantial impact means a couple of things. One, developing concrete demands that can be organized around both locally and nationally. And that's not to say that some formations in different localities have not had demands, because they have. And Chicago, I think, is a fantastic example of that, where, you know, there was a demand, for example, for reparations to be paid to black men who had been tortured by Chicago police in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s, and there was a successful campaign waged around that. But there are other issues to be organized around, such as decriminalization, for example, such as campaigns to weaken the grip of police unions, campaigns to create accountability around illegal policing, what to do with cops who kill, cops who abuse and murder. There are those sorts of things. I think that the movement has to actively develop its relationship with other people, other groups of people who are victimized by state violence. So developing relationships between the undocumented and immigrant rights movement, people who know something about state violence, developing relationships between the Arab and Muslim communities that are organizations that are fighting against Islamophobia in the U.S.'s never-ending war on terror. I think even among white working class people, one of the things that is often overlooked is that, of course, policing is disproportionately focused on black communities in this country. But if you look at the United States in the context of the rest of the world, the rate at which the U.S. arrests white people in this country is unprecedented anywhere else in the world. If we look at the numbers of people who have been killed by the police in the last decade, which there are some estimates of up to 11,000 people have been killed by police violence, thousands of them are white people. And so I think that there is an objective basis upon building networks and coalitions to stop the intense hyper-policing that exists in American society. And within that, raising larger questions about why do we live in a country where this sort of policing is not disciplined, is not reined in, but is actually rewarded and paid and bought for. I mean, we look at the amount of money that municipalities who are more than willing to close public schools and public hospitals, the amount of money they are willing to pay out to settle brutality, police brutality and police murder cases, it shocks the conscience. And so these are things that are not just affecting black people, even if they overwhelmingly affect black people, but these are things that affect almost anyone, ordinary working class people in this country. And so the means exist to build a much broader and bigger movement that is able to impose its will on elected officials and on the existing institutions.
Kianga, it's been lovely having you with us.
Kianga, we want our audience to continue this conversation with you by reading your book. Hashtag Black Lives Matters to Black Liberation. Every success to you, and a shout out to young Ellison.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Well, thanks.
We're going to have you on again. Thank you so much
have
for being our guest.
Day.
All right, take care.
You take
care.
It easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. group of attorneys and legal activists involved in Ferguson, Baltimore, and Cleveland protests have formed the Black Movement Law Project. The project provides legal support skills and training to local communities across the nation as they take to the streets to protest police misconduct and systemic racism. Their approach to community activism is itself community-based. They offer legal and technical assistance based on the premise that local mass movements frequently lack legal expertise. They help arrange rapid responses to support activists on the ground when asked. Their technical assistance initiatives are designed to support community groups in building and sustaining their own infrastructure. They also help connect local groups to national human and civil rights networks to bolster access to legal representation, policy assistance, and long-term impact litigation. Joining us to talk about the Black Movement Law Project are founders Abi Hassan and Nathan Sheard. Welcome, Abi and Nathan, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Nathan, can I refer to you as Nash?
Yes, please.
Great. Okay. Now, Abi, I know you from the National Lawyers Guild, where you were the National Mass Defense Coordinator. But, Nash, how did you get involved in activism?
It's an interesting story. So my career path, I spent many years, 10 years really, in the music industry doing radio promotion and really not really feeling like the work I was doing. I look at record labels now as kind of like banks that lend out money to artists and use their talent as the capital for it, and recognize that we're really exploiting a lot of the artists and not really comfortable with the way that the industry was shaping up. And also it was musical chairs at that point. And through actually Occupy Wall Street really got involved with doing a lot of facilitation and direct action. And since I was getting arrested, I was getting a lot of other people arrested, and really looking at it from a standpoint that your action's not over until everyone's out. I ended up doing a lot of jail support, and through that got involved with Mutant Legal and doing popular legal education, trainings on doing jail support and court support. And from that ended up in Ferguson after Michael Brown got killed, and they knew that we had experience in responding to situations of mass arrest, and spent the fall of 2015 out there. And then when Freddie Gray was killed, I was asked to come out and build the jail support system in Baltimore.
So you're good at, and I know, Abi, and your work has involved a lot of helping to set up infrastructures for rapid legal response around the country. How did you two meet? In Ferguson?
Actually, we'd met before that because Mutant Legal, around the time that Edward Snowden released all the documents and information that he did, Mutant Legal was really looking at some of the responses from people that were saying, well, I have nothing to hide, so I'm not really concerned. And so we put together a panel called Nothing to Hide, So Much to Lose. And Abi was one of the speakers on that panel.
And Mutant Legal is New York-based? It's a law collective?
Yeah, Mutant Legal is a law collective that came out of some of the jail support and legal support working groups in Occupy Wall Street, and really recognizing that a lot of the things that we were doing, this kind of support that we were building, was really having a profound impact on the outcomes of cases that activists had, but that members of targeted communities didn't have access to that information, and trying to address that concern.
So, Abi, what kind of specific needs have you been seeing during and after these recent protests? Because I know you've done national special security event support at the RNC and DNC over the last 4 to 8 years. Are the needs that you're seeing in Black Lives Matter and other movements different?
You know, I think dealing with the police is dealing with the police. And so I think the police have different relationships and relate differently to other communities. And frankly, part of the problem is really in the communities being supported. So as Nash mentioned, he noticed a real big difference when there are these jail support mechanisms and there are lawyers available to get people out of jail. And that is common in a lot of activist communities. But as we were seeing uprisings in Baltimore, Ferguson, a lot of those communities didn't have that kind of support. And so that's kind of the gap we're hoping to help fill is trying to bring that to specifically Black communities that are activists by speaking out. Even if they're not like part of these big organizations, a lot of people are just natural activists. And so we want to help them build that same infrastructure.
So did Black Movement Law Project organize support for Baltimore or Ferguson or here in New York City? Or when did you guys start working on this stuff?
Yeah, as individual members, I did as respond to the call to Mutant Legal to go to Ferguson and build jail support and help solidify the jail support system there. And then individually in the roles that we were, me as Mutant Legal and Abby in his position at the time with as the Master Defense Coordinator at the National Lawyers Guild, went down and helped build the system of legal support and legal observation in Baltimore. And then really where we were in a room one day and looking at what are the mechanisms that exist in medium-sized cities around the country and where are the black lawyers and legal workers and activists that are doing the work and recognizing that there was a need to build support for those communities and to be able to share those skills.
So when did you launch your project?
Last summer out of Baltimore. And I'd like to add that there's a third member of our organization. There's a third and fourth member who we also met in Baltimore, Nicole Lee, who's one of the principals, and a law student, Marcus Banks, who has been doing a bunch of amazing work in those same cities. And, you know, we don't really work that much in New York. We recently did a digital security training in New York in partnership with a New York organization and the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. But we mostly are focused on the mid-sized cities that don't have the resources and the consolidated legal support mechanisms that the bigger cities like New York, San Francisco, Chicago have. So we're focusing on those smaller cities where it's harder to get that critical mass, and we're trying to, you know, help build that.
I want to note that I actually attended an hour or so of that meeting that you co-sponsored with Electronic Frontier Foundation and the other group, focusing on technology security. Is that the kind of support or technical assistance that you see as integral to meeting some of the needs of activists in addition to pure legal support?
Yeah, and that other group was Crypto Party Harlem,
which is
a monthly crypto party in New York City that people can learn some of those digital security skills, which is actually, it's a really great crypto party. But I think that that's something that has been emerging as a consistent need from activist communities and a consistent worry, right? There's a huge chilling effect that people feel from knowing that they're being spied on. And so, you know, we try to offer a lot of different services. We do the Legal Observer training, often in conjunction with National Lawyers Guild. We do jail support trainings. We're doing a whole series of these digital security trainings. We'd like to do more of a policy training. Our colleague Nicole Lee is a real policy expert and has many years of experience doing policy work in international law. So we're trying to respond to needs that we hear. And also, it's not like we're just doing it all. We're also trying to connect people to existing groups and forge kind of broader communities.
That was a really wonderful attendance and a group that you had at that technology training. How do you do outreach in addition to social media, sort of grassroots?
So it's going to be different the way it presents itself in each city, because each city has different histories of different types of activism and the way that communities interrelate with each other. And so really one of the, like, we definitely don't engage in, whenever we go to a city, it's really important that it's some place that we've been invited to come out, to come and build the kind of support mechanisms that we have and to share those skills. And so very early on, from once we're invited in, we try to look at, what is the landscape in that city? Who are the existing organizations? Where and how can we tie and build and support the bonds that may exist or help create new bonds between those groups that already exist, and then use and then work with the systems that they have in place, and also through our networks that we have nationally to try to support that work.
I'm curious about the demographics of groups and individuals that you see in the streets now. It seems to me that in Black Lives Matter and other related actions, we have a lot of younger as well as older, a cross-section of individuals. Have you noticed any sort of new groups emerging that might have special needs that need to be taken into consideration vis-a-vis dealing with police, for example?
A lot of the work that I do is around training with jail support, and the reason that work is so important to me, and really, like, the capacity that we have is really to support people who have been arrested during uprising and different political actions. I would love it if some of those tools and resources are spread out to the larger community of people that are being targeted by police and over policing, broken windows and what have you. But that's actually, like, for me, the thing that's always in the back of my mind is the folks who are not part of an existing collective or organization and who come to an action or come to a space for the first time and don't have that. Like, if I know that if I'm arrested, there is a community of people who will respond and have those tools and resources. I think that what is really important to be able to identify is making sure that we're building systems that actually are helping the people who don't have that support system already in place.
So do you have a network of lawyers, particularly in these middle-sized, underserved cities, that you can call on if people are in a jam?
Yeah, I mean, we work with multiple organizations. I can name the groups that we've worked with. NLG is one of them for sure. The National Bar Association. We work with a coalition of people through the Lawyers Committee. That is a police reform coalition in different locations. We've worked with the National Conference of Black Lawyers. We just did a training with them in Detroit about a month and a half ago. So we're really connected to a lot of the major organizations, and really the outreach in any particular place depends on the location. Because, you know, some places, you know, the organization of lawyers is not one of those. It's like something else that's what they do in that city. So it's really about going in and finding the terrain and figuring out who's active in what area. We've also worked with NAACP. I mean, I can name organizations.
You know, it's absolutely thrilling for me to sit across from you two men and hear that there's enough need out there in the movement that you responded to. Tell me, is this something that you think has come up in the last several years with this crisis of police abuse? How would you gauge the speed and development of the movement now?
I mean, that's a difficult question that I think is not, there's no simple answer. I think, obviously, the level of police abuse and the treatment of black communities, communities of color generally, has been bad for a long time, right? I think that we all kind of know that. There's an interesting confluence happening now of the rise kind of social media, of the visibility through, you know, technology, really, through cell phone videos, of, you know, and that combined with social media bringing these things to the fore. There's also a huge amount of, I think, political disaffection that we've seen from Occupy to, you know, the uprisings that we've seen, and that's becoming more palpable. And, you know, as our society is creating a bleaker and bleaker future for the young, for the youth, right, it's just everything is coming to a boiling point, right? And so, in terms of, I don't see the underlying conditions for a movement going away. I think that it's really about what types of mobilizations and organizations are created. And, like, that's really our, that's what we see, like, as our role in the movement is trying to help keep those things together, because spending a month in jail can really affect your ability to want to go out and do activism, right? Having your group spied on by the FBI, as we saw in the COINTELPRO days, has the ability to destroy organizations and set back a progressive political agenda for generations. So, you know, we play a very small role in that, in trying to help people build the tools that they need to kind of counter some of that stuff. But, you know, our opponents are the most powerful factions on this planet. So it's hard to say how long or how the give and take is going to go. But, you know, the only option we see is to keep doing the best we can to support those groups and to fight those who would destroy us.
And I would just add to that one of the things that made us recognize that there was a need for something like the Black Movement Law Project was because in each of those spaces that we'd engage prior to the creation, we recognized that we were always 36 hours late, right? Something would happen, and then we would have to respond and help the people who are already being engaged with the system and try to make sure there were mechanisms to support people going forward. And so one of the things that we would like to do as we continue to build capacity is to be able to go in, and what we have begun to do is go in and build the systems of support and share the skills and connect the resources so that when those things happen, there are already local groups who are trained and have connections to folks who will be able to help them respond to those moments when they happen rather than after the fact.
I'd like to ask you both, do you have an example of something that you're really proud of that you've done in the last year that you might share with our listeners?
Well, one example of the proof of concept was interesting. As we, in one of the cities that we engaged in, it was interesting because we'd been asked by a local group to come in and help and build this work, because we'd worked with some of the members in Ferguson and in Baltimore. And when we got there on the ground, it was really interesting that there was some pushback from local attorneys that they really felt that, like, oh, well, you know, there was a, we'll just, if this happens, then I'll just represent all the people. And we're like, that's great if there's 4 people that have been arrested, but if there's 36 people, if there's 40 people that are arrested, like, how will you do that? And unfortunately, in that particular instance, what actually ended up happening was, while we were on the ground actually doing trainings, there was an incident that resulted in over 70 people being arrested, and unfortunately, one of the people that was arrested was the attorney who had said that they would represent everyone if should something happen. And luckily, because we'd been there for 2 or 3 days and had built the training and had built the resources and made the connections, we were able to respond really quickly and be able to identify one that. Since there were a number of legal observers that had been trained, and we had folks outside of the jails when people were released, getting documentation and being able to support people and making sure we connect them with representation, a lot of people ended up getting their cases dismissed because it became evident many of them had been arrested for failure to disperse, and there had not been a dispersal order within a reasonable time or space to where they were actually kettled and arrested. So it was a great experience that actually, like, we'd come in and been able to negotiate with and help provide some of those skills and resources and understanding, and that those things were in place when it happened in a way that there wouldn't have been had it not happened in that way.
When Bill Kunstler would give a speech and people would come up to him afterwards, he would hand out his business card and he would tell them, this is a get out of jail free card. I think knowing you guys is next best thing to that. How do you get in touch with your project?
Oh, I mean, we have email and a website, bmlp.org. We can be reached through the bmlp.org is the website. So you could reach us at info@bmlp.org or just go to the website and there's a form.
I have a question about punctuation. Your name hyphenates movement law. Can you explain why?
That was a long process of coming up with a name. I think that we wanted to just emphasize that that our focus was going to be on movement law, like the law related to movements. The name doesn't actually fully encompass everything we do. Like, we're not a strictly legal organization, right? So Nash is not a lawyer and proud of it. And
you are.
Yeah. And I'm not going to say I'm proud of it, but, you know, it is what it is.
We have a segment on our show called Lawyers You'll Like, and we'll include you in that.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, Abby's absolutely right, and that's really what we wanted to emphasize. But I want to say an important part that comes up when you mention the fact that I'm not an attorney and proud of it is one of the parts of the work that we really like to emphasize is the fact that there are so many ways. There's some very narrow and important things that only an attorney can do in supporting communities in this way and through the work that we do. But there are so many ways that folks who are not attorneys can support their communities and make the work more sustainable. And so it's really important that we make more awareness on how folks who want to engage in supporting their communities, there are many avenues in helping them respond to interaction with the police in the state.
And frankly, there's things that lawyers can't do. So it's right. you got to have everyone.
Right, and as we at Law and Disorder believe that any legal movement is only as effective as the people on the ground raising awareness of it in the streets, literally. So you need a strong public support.
Nash, I'd like you to please repeat the contact information for our audience, please.
Yeah, absolutely. We can be reached via email at info@bmlp.org, and that's our website as well, bmlp.org, or Facebook, a Black Movement Law Project.
I want to ask, are you planning to attend the Republican and Democratic National Conventions this summer?
Yeah, you know, we're figuring that out. I think that we're definitely going to be around Cleveland for the RNC because there seems to be organizing going on around that, and we have a connection to Cleveland that we've been working there for the past 8 months or so, you know, and in various capacities, like BMLP members are working with the organizing groups in Philadelphia for the DNC. We haven't figured out fully what, like, we haven't been asked by any particular groups to, like, support their actions yet. So we're keeping a very close eye on that and anticipate involvement.
Well, I just wanted to say it's wonderful to learn about what you guys are doing. Heidi and I wish you every success. You know, go out there and make trouble.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Johnson Publications. A whole lot of stations didn't want to play that particular record, We're a Winner. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, I would say the way I'm sure most of you would say, we don't give a damn, we're a winner anyway. Right on? Yeah, I got a little strength out there tonight. Putting fire under us. Out of sight. It's all right now. We We have just another version that we'd like to lay to you about here, believing very strongly in the equality and freedom for all, and especially we people who are darker than blue. We'd like to just lay another version to you, trying not to offend anyone, but basically telling it like it is. We're a winner, and never let anybody say, boy, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, the black boy done dried his eye. And we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up. There'll be no more Uncle Tom, at last that blessed day has come. And we're a winner, and everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing, like Martin Luther told you to. And I don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear, cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, we're moving on up. So people get ready, I've got good news for you. How we got over, like we're all supposed to do. Let us all say amen, and together we'll clap our hands, cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up. Continue to be a winner, all of you.